So good morning again. Now I'm being recorded for those who listen later on. And I hope you've all been enjoying spending time with the Vimalakirti Sutra over these weeks. We're coming down the home stretch of our practice period. It's quite an enjoyable sutra, I hope you've found, unlike some of the more difficult Buddhist texts. And we can easily see how it would have been used as an oral teaching in the days when few people were literate. The stories, the colorful characters, the humorous exchanges, lively dialogues, elaborate special effects, quite psychedelic at times. Of superpowers and visionary cosmic realms. And we can enjoy that even now in our age of high-tech virtual reality. We can enjoy using our imagination in this text. Because it's easy to forget the power of the imagination when we are bombarded with so much from outside. From the media. But we need the power of the imagination to generate not just frightening apocalyptic images that are readily available, but visions of how to live on this earth together with all beings in peace and in balance. So I hope you found this text inspiring and encouraging, as well as enjoyable. Because it offers many practices and perspectives that help us to negotiate our daily lives not as monks in a peace on some remote mountain monastery, but as lay people living right in the midst of the muck and mess of our daily lives in human existence. And so this is really Vimalakirti was known as the master of skillful means of responding to beings in all realms of existence, and so the sutra itself is a skillful means of teaching in all these different ways. As Vimalakirti says, the lotus does not grow on the upland plain. The lotus grows in the mud and mire of damp, low-lying places. So that's our lives, right? It is only when living beings are in the midst of the mire of earthly life that they turn to the Buddha Dharma. So that's what Vimalakirti said earlier. And I think most of you have been here for at least some of the talks as we've gone along, and so you know that the action in this story begins in Vimalakirti's sick room, where he uses his own illness to teach a huge assembly of beings who manage to fit in magically into this room, to teach them about impermanence and about suffering and basic Buddhist teachings. If you were here last Sunday, you heard Susan's talk where Vimalakirti invited all the bodhisattvas that assembled to tell their best way of entering the gate of non-duality. And at the end, Vimalakirti is asked to give his best way to enter the gate of non-duality, and we hear his thunderous silence. Right? But he's not done. He still has more to say. In the subsequent chapters. And those who were here Wednesday evening heard Michael talk about how Vimalakirti sends a bodhisattva as an emissary to a cosmic realm where the resident Buddha teaches the Dharma using only fragrances. Wasn't that lovely? And he returns. The bodhisattva emissary returns with a bowl of fragrant rice to nourish the assembly in Vimalakirti's room. which was a beautiful and timely image, given that on Monday night we had just done our ceremony of offering the nourishment to the Dharma to the hungry ghost realm. The hungry ghost realm in our world and in ourselves. Which happened to fall on Halloween this year, so that was a bonus. So this next chapter likewise takes us into another realm. We're traveling into these cosmic realms now from Vimalakirti's little room. And in this realm, the Buddha is teaching in a place called Amra Gardens. And suddenly everything and everyone there appears beautiful and bathed in golden light. And the Buddha's attendant Shariputra, Ananda. Something wasn't right. The Buddha's attendant Ananda says, "What's going on?" Everything is suddenly golden. And the Buddha replies, "It's because Vimalakirti has just decided to bring the great assembly gathered in his sick room to this garden to pay his respects." And in that same instant, Vimalakirti says to Manjushri, the Bodhisattva of wisdom, back in the sick room, "Let's go pay our respects to the Buddha." And Manjushri says, "Excellent, this is a perfect time to go." So Vimalakirti uses his superpowers to gather up this host, thousands of disciples and bodhisattvas and other beings, including their lion seats, in the palm of his hand, and conveys them to this realm where the Buddha is in the garden and deposits them on the ground. At this point in our book, that I noticed as I was reading a little pencil note that Michael had made that says, "Monkey King." Does anyone know why? So I thought, wait a minute, what? And I asked Michael. And he reminded me of an episode in the epic 16th century Chinese novel Journey to the West, which features a character known as the Monkey King, Sun Wukong. Probably not pronounced right, but who is born from a magical stone. And after many adventures, he acquires great superpowers from training with a Taoist sage in martial arts and other magic. The Monkey King becomes quite full of himself and creates such havoc in the heavenly realm that the Jade Emperor appeals to the Buddha to intervene. This is very, very compressed. The Buddha scoops the Monkey King up into the palm of his hand and makes a bet with him that he cannot escape, that the Monkey King cannot escape his Buddha's hand. The Monkey King confidently accepts the bet and leaps into the air, flies to the end of the world, and all he sees are five pillars. So what do monkeys do? Mark their territory. He pisses on one of the pillars. And then flies back to the Buddha's hand, sure that he's won the bet. And when he lands, he realizes that he had never left the palm of the Buddha's hand, that the pillars were the five fingers, and what has he done? So of course he tries to escape again. The Buddha turns his hand over, the Monkey King drops, and a cascade of kind of a landslide of rocks buries the Monkey King. Of course he survives. And 500 years later, the Bodhisattva of compassion, Guanyin, rescues him on the condition that he will accompany the monk Tan Sanzang on a pilgrimage to the West, which means India, to bring back the Buddhist sutras. So with two other companions, called in English Pigsy and Sandy, who are also atoning for their past wrongdoings, they embark on this great journey with the monk, full of dangerous encounters, in the course of which the Monkey King receives many, many Dharma teachings. And after they return successfully, he attains Buddhahood. It's a great, there's a Hong Kong film production of Monkey King, Journey to the West, which was quite spectacular. Around, I don't know, 2015 or so. It was really great.
The director of Kung Fu Hustle, if anybody remembers that.
Yeah. Oh. So there are lots of references to the Monkey King once you know what you're seeing. And I couldn't help but wonder if the author or authors of the Vimalakirti Sutra would have known this story. I almost certainly they would have known the Monkey King story about the Buddha and the Monkey King in the palm of his hand. Sorry, the other way around.
Yeah.
Would have known the story of Vimalakirti holding all those disciples and bodhisattvas and supernatural beings in the palm of his hand when he created the story of Buddha and the Monkey King. Because it's such a powerful metaphor for boundlessness, isn't it? The boundless capacity of the palm of the hand. And it's not limited to Buddhist imagery. There's William Blake's, to see a world in a grain of sand and heaven in a wildflower, hold infinity in the palm of your hand and eternity in an hour. The boundless capacity of the hand is also the boundless capacity of the heart in these images, right? Anyway, so back to the story. After placing all the assembly on the ground, Vimalakirti bows to the Buddha and circumambulates him clockwise 7 times, walks around the Buddha, and then all the thousands and thousands of bodhisattvas and other beings do the same, which of course doesn't take all that long in these kinds of stories. And after formal greetings, the Buddha asks them to take their seats. And next comes a really wonderful dialogue between the Buddha, Ananda, Shariputra, and the Buddha's disciple, Shariputra, who pipes up in the way he typically does in this sutra, not wanting to be left out. And Vimalakirti, who, as usual, delivers a profound teaching. So I'm now going to enlist our helpers, starting with the Buddha.
Did you see what those great bodhisattvas just did through their supernatural powers?
I sure did.
What did you think of it?
I was blown away. It was incredible. I don't understand it. And what's that fragrance? I've never smelled anything like it before.
That fragrance is coming from the pores of the bodhisattvas.
It's coming from our pores too, not just the bodhisattvas.
Where does it come from?
It comes from the rice left over from the Buddha's meal that the rich man Vimalakirti had brought from the country many fragrances. The pores of everyone who ate it at his house emit this kind of fragrance.
How long will this fragrant aroma last?
Until the rice is digested.
And how long will it be before the rice is digested?
The power of this rice is such that it will be 7 days before it is digested.
So now I'm going to just paraphrase. Vimalakirti explains further that people at different stages of practice will not fully digest the rice until they've reached the next stage. So it can take a very long time. Like so many stage models of development, progression in Dharma practice is not so linear and stepwise as the model presents. But the message here is that it takes as long as it takes to fully mature on the bodhisattva path and to fully digest and manifest it in our lives. So next comes one of the loveliest passages in this chapter. Ananda, do you have?
Yeah. I've never heard of such a thing. World honored one, to think that this fragrant rice can be used to do the Buddha's work.
Okay, now there's a lot to pack in here, so I'm going to paraphrase the Buddha's reply and shorten it a bit. The Buddha says, just so, Ananda. There are some Buddha lands where the radiant light of the Buddha is used to do the Buddha's work. Somewhere bodhisattvas are used to do the Buddha's work. Somewhere phantom beings conjured up by the Buddha are used for the Buddha's work. Somewhere the Bodhi tree is used. Somewhere the Buddha's garments or bedding are used. Anyone who's sewn the Buddha's robe, a rakasu or an akesa, knows that is a way. Somewhere gardens, groves, pavilions, and towers are used to do the Buddha's work. Somewhere the 32 features and 80 characteristics, auspicious marks that accompany the body of the Buddha are used. Somewhere the Buddha's body is used, and somewhere empty space is used for the Buddha's work. There are lands where similes such as dreams, phantoms, reflections, echoes, images in a mirror, the moon in the water, or shimmering heat waves are used to do the Buddha's work. There are some where voices, spoken words, or written words are used. Or Buddha lands where tranquil silence, without words, without explanations, without cognition, without action, without conditioning, do the Buddha's work. Thus, Ananda, among all daily activities of the Buddhas, their comings and goings, every act that they carry out, there is not one that does not do the Buddha's work. Isn't that lovely? Then the Buddha describes a Dharma gate that when the bodhisattvas enter it, if they see a land of purity and beauty, they will not get all excited and think, oh, I've made it, I'm here, this is it. And if they think, if they enter this gate and see that the land is torn with war and conflict and contaminated by human greed, like our world appears to be so often, they will not be downcast or discouraged. So this is sort of a magical gate that when they enter, it shifts their view. The bodhisattvas who have come from the world of many fragrances, it doesn't say how they got here, but somehow they're here too. They are so impressed by the Buddha's words that they confess, "World honored one, when we first saw this land, we thought it was thought of it as base and inferior. I mean, look where they're coming from. Just heavenly fragrances showing up in our world. But now we regret our error and have put such thoughts out of our mind. Why? Because the skillful means employed by the Buddhas are beyond comprehension. In order to save living beings, they manifest different kinds of Buddha lands depending on what is appropriate to the circumstances. Very well then, we would like you to bestow a little of your teachings on us so that when we return to our own land, we will have something to remember you by." So the Buddha, they want to know, what to do if they're in a different kind of world from this world of heavenly fragrances. And this is the teaching the Buddha offers them. Bodhisattvas do not exhaust the conditioned, and they do not dwell in the unconditioned. Okay, so first we have to know what conditioned and unconditioned mean. So the conditioned is our everyday world, right? We're conditioned by so many things, so many causes, so many karmic causes and effects. The conditioned is the phenomenal world, the world of duality, right and wrong, black and white, male and female dualities. South of the border, it's the blue and the red. Here in Canada, we have our own share of dualities and disconnections. The unconditioned is the world beyond duality, the perspective of boundless interconnection and unity. So how can we not exhaust the conditioned, meaning to be done with it once and for all, and get out of here. And how can we not dwell in the unconditioned, sort of suspended in bliss, forgetting about the world right before our eyes? So the Buddha gives a long list of examples for each of these, which I will try and condense a little bit. Not exhausting the conditioned means not setting aside great compassion, giving profound expression to the mind of comprehensive wisdom and never forgetting it, working tirelessly to plant the roots of goodness, to keep the will at all time fixed on skillful means, purposely entering the realm of birth and death with no feelings of fear, facing all types of honor or disgrace without thoughts of sadness or joy. It's not so easy, is it? You know, yeah, honor's nice, but it can backfire. And disgrace, ooh, nobody wants that, right? How can we experience those arisings without being snagged? Not looking with contempt on those who have yet to learn, and respecting the wise as though they were the Buddha himself. It means arousing correct thoughts in those sunk in earthly desires, but without unduly prizing the desire to remove oneself. Yeah, so how can we be with others, sometimes a friend perhaps, who's really in the grip of an aversive state? How can we have that capacity and not set ourselves up as beyond all that? It means looking on meditative states as though they were a form of hell, but on the realm of birth and death as though contemplating a garden. Now that seems like a rather extreme thing to say, but you can see what he's doing is just turning upside down our conventional view of meditative states as being bliss states that we strive for, and this world of birth and death as being kind of repulsive. He's just turning that upside down. And we can see, even in our zazen, even in our practice, how we make those dualistic judgments. Oh, this is a really terrible sit. Or, oh, this is such a good sit. I felt so peaceful. Right? Or I'm a bad meditator because I can't empty my mind of thoughts. You know, we can watch this and we can turn it. The Buddha is saying, just meet your life. Just meet the world. Fully awake in each moment with an open mind and a kind heart. And that's the way you'll be able to use skillful means in your everyday life. He continues, with regard to worldly things, lessening desires, knowing what is enough. With regard to unworldly things, tirelessly seeking them and yet not rejecting the things of the world. So you see how these patterns that he's setting up. Knowing what is enough, that's such a good one. How much our society needs that. It's what Dogen, in his one text from Dogen, who's the founder of our branch of Zen in Japan, calls it one of the eight awakenings of great beings. Knowing how much is enough is one of them. He says, if you want to be free from suffering, you should contemplate knowing how much is enough. By knowing it, you are in the place of enjoyment and peacefulness. If you know how much is enough, you are content even when you sleep on the ground. If you don't know it, you are discontent even when you are in heaven. You can feel rich even if you are poor. You can feel poor even if you have much wealth. You may have noticed that on occasion. When that mind of not enough starts to go. The Buddha continues, not exhausting the conditioned means never breaking the precepts of right conduct, yet being able to accommodate to the ways of the world. That's not so easy, is it? You know, if you're working in a workplace where there's something unethical is going on and you want to maintain your integrity, how do you do that? You know, these are if these things come up. Calling up wisdom to guide living beings, acquiring concentration and retention of memories so that you never forget what you have heard, being able to distinguish the different capacities of people correctly, expounding the Dharma with a pleasing and appropriate eloquence that flows unimpeded. To me, that says, just trust that you'll say what needs to be said, and don't stress. And have confidence. Cultivating the four immeasurables, loving kindness, compassion, equanimity, and joy, using the teachings to create a community of bodhisattvas, never self-indulgent in mind, never missing an opportunity for acts of goodness. One who practices these methods may be called a bodhisattva who does not exhaust the conditioned. You could just choose one or two of those to take up, you know, or just one, any one of those to take up and say, I'm really going to bring awareness to that one this week and see what you notice. So if you want to go back to the text and you know, just which one really jumps out at you, right, of these. And then, what does not dwelling in the unconditioned mean? Here's what the Buddha says. It means that one studies and practices the teachings on emptiness, but does not take emptiness to be enlightenment. So he says, sure, study all the two sutras, you know, read your books, but don't think that means you're enlightened. Don't even think if you can talk the talk that means you're enlightened. It's enlightenment only exists in the living of it in each moment, each day. And we can slip so easily into delusion. And then he lists a number of other teachings, and again, cautions to take up those teachings, but don't think that means you're enlightened. And then he notes what are called the marks of existence. Impermanence. He says, one views things as impermanent, but does not neglect to cultivate the roots of goodness. So you can't just say, oh yeah, well, everything's impermanent, so what? It doesn't mean a kind of disengagement. One views the world as marked by suffering, but does not hate to be born and die in it. One sees that there is no permanent self, but is tireless in helping others. So non-self, that's another of the marks of existence, meaning no separate independent self. But we don't use that as an excuse to disengage and remove ourselves. One sees that there is such a thing as nirvana, but does not dwell there for long. One sees that there is no destination, yet one makes the good Dharma one's destination. One sees that there is no birth, yet one takes on the form of birth in order to share the burdens of others. One sees that there is nothing to be practiced, yet one practices the Dharma in order to teach and help living beings. One embraces the view of emptiness or boundlessness, yet does not discard one's great compassion. When one practices these methods, one may be called a bodhisattva who does not dwell in the unconditioned. As I was reading this, I kept hearing little lines that reminded me of passages in Dogen. You know, how our practice and awakening are not separate things. They're actualized in every moment. And I can't help but wonder how well acquainted Dogen was with Vimalakirti. And this is an early Mahayana sutra, so we can see the roots of how this way of thinking about bodhisattva path evolved. The Buddha is making it abundantly clear that our practice is not nihilistic or escapist or indifferent. He's describing what it's like to be a bodhisattva in a world like ours, to those bodhisattvas from the world of many fragrances who could not imagine a world like this. And we might wish sometimes to live in one of those worlds where the Dharma is communicated by just fragrances or sounds or images or trees. But really, we already do. We already do. Our world contains countless Dharma gates. There are countless wise and compassionate means to help ourselves and others to see them and enter them. And it's not only the Buddha's hand that can hold countless beings or extend to the ends of the earth. It's ours, it's yours. The boundless open hand is the boundless open heart. So I would like to invite you to just hold your hand out in front of you and take a look at it. Just really look at this hand. What a marvel. What a marvel. Thich Nhat Hanh, the beloved Vietnamese Zen teacher Thich Nhat Hanh, tells us, if you look deeply into the palm of your hand, you will see your parents and all generations of your ancestors. All of them are alive in this moment. Each is present in your body. You are the continuation of each of these people. And then I'm going to add, not only our blood ancestors, but our cultural ancestors. And if we look deeply enough into the palm of our hand, we can see our evolutionary ancestors. We can see the opposable thumbs of our primate ancestors, the paws of our early mammal ancestors, the fins of our sea-dwelling ancestors. If you look deeply enough, you can see the whole world in your hand. You've got the whole world in your hand, you got the whole wide world. In your hand, you got the whole world. In your hand, you got the whole world in your hand. You got you and me, brother. In your hand, you got you and me, sister. In your hand, you got you and me, brother. In your hand, you got the whole world in your hand. You got the mountains and the waters. In your hand, you got the mountains and the waters. In your hand, you got the mountains and the waters. In your hand, you got the whole world in your hand. You got the plants and the animals. In your hand, you got the plants and the animals. In your hand, you got the plants and the animals. In your hand, you got the whole world in your hand. You got the whole world. In your hand, you got the whole wide world. In your hand, you got the whole world. In your hand, you got the whole world in your hands. You didn't know you were going to get to sing that. Thank you, everyone, for listening today. Please go out into the world with your hands wide open and your heart. Let's chant.
Page 3.
May our intention equally extend to every being and place. With the true merit of Buddha's way, beings are numberless. I vow to save them.
Delusions are inexhaustible.
I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them.
Buddha's way is unsurpassable.